Pod. 22 grand. Pod. In the city that sounds nice. Huh. Yeah, so like you mentioned, you've been in Margate for 7 years. It's funny because I don't know if you've been to the Albion Rooms, but someone from there got in touch with me about potentially doing like a live show there, but just need some potential guests. But I think there is a few people that live down there, like yourself. But yeah, nice place to live there by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it's cool. We were kind of, I feel like, part of an East London scene that was just moving further and further east. And around the time my friends, you know, growing up a bit and moving out of London a bit more, and when the Moshi Moshi guys had bought houses in Margate for like weekend retreats, I was like, oh, I'll check it out, because if you're going to be there, then, you know, we can have our meetings where I say, like, I still haven't finished an album. we can do that, you know, we can do that in Margate. So, and it's kind of easier. It was just like, we just go all the way east, you know, we just be like, the most East London possible is the very edge of Margate, literally where we live. And it's great. Yeah. You know, I mean, I was nearly trying to move to LA after the third album, because KCRW, radio station out there, who I've been a big fan of for years, was playing my track Sherman quite a lot, and I got asked to go out to play their Halloween like masked ball event, and then we put an LA show in proper as well, and I was just really, really, really taken with LA, checking out some of the places that I'd seen in films and that kind of stuff. I just like the idea of living, well, obviously the Californian lifestyle is pretty nice, it seems to me. Everyone's like, oh, you got to drive everywhere, and I'm like, I love driving, I love cars. I love driving. My idea of having a driveway and a bungalow, you know, in an area of LA, I was like, that's amazing. But and people kind of roll their eyes at me for this, but it's like, you know, at the height of summer in certain places of Margate, it's a little bit like LA. I'm going to say it. Or it's enough anyway for me to be like, oh, this is great. And it's like, actually, it's a bit hot, isn't it? So yeah, no, it's cool. And I think, you know, you should just do it if anyone wants to. So if everyone is scared of leaving a big city, you just got to go. Take the scene with you, you know. It's like, if you're not, London was becoming a bit of a shame. It's like my old studio got knocked down, and there's like a block of flats now on where the studio was that I recorded Leisure Seizure in, and my friend Rory, we recorded loads of bands there as well, which was awesome. Rory from Test Icicles.
Okay, right.
You know, did loads of, and still is, like, you know, a pretty prolific producer of kind of cool underground bands. It was cool when that worked, and then it just felt a bit oppressive after a while, and a lot of the venues closing down and stuff. So it's cool. I like being by the sea, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean about America as well. Like, I'm just constantly intrigued by it and the idea of living there, even though it won't happen now. But
yeah, I mean, it was all before, you know, the political kind of craziness, I suppose. So, but I guess it's like everywhere, isn't it? You can't really, like, nowhere seems to be perfect at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I like the idea of space a bit more, and the thing I realized was, like, I felt like London had a real sort of like noir element to me. I think I realized that was like the best way of describing it. Like, I could handle the kind of kind of grime and stuff when it was like as a young person, I think that's kind of like there's something like romantic about a city, you know, a mean city. It's like, I don't know, with the Gotham syndrome. And then at some point when you're like, oh, you know, it would be nice if it was just a bit like less grotty. And as soon as that creeps in, it's like, you know, you can't afford to have that in London. So, yeah. But now it's fun going back now because it's like this sort of theatrically over the top place now to me. And it doesn't stress me out because when I was there and things were changing, it would like stress me out a bit. And then now I go back and it's like, oh, this place is hilarious. You know, I can. There's loads of food options. That's great. There's loads of cafes. That's great. You know, that was it. So it was fun being back for this this London show that I've just done. So yeah, I've got London at a safe distance. You know,
good album title. Yeah, you mentioned California, and it's skipping ahead a bit, but I was watching a clip of you on the Earth Sea back in the day. Was that quite fun to do? Or was it a bit of a long day kind of thing?
Yeah, it was. That was kind of crazy because the lead up to that was quite an intense time for me because we had gone on a US tour for We Have Sound. And it had been a really turbulent time because we had gone straight in from doing South by Southwest straight into this US tour. And in the process, I had a bit of my live band was a bit of like ramshackle bunch of people that I found from various places at the time. Cause I didn't know, like I was usually the drummer in bands. I was drumming in loads of bands. I didn't know another drummer. So I grabbed this guy that I just met. But there was this whole like drama. Well, what happened? Like South by Southwest, the drummer and the guitarist get in a fight and the drummer breaks the guitarist's finger and loses his passport. And so we're like rehearsing for this US tour. I'm rehearsing a new guitarist who's got to learn all the stuff. And I'm drumming in the rehearsals because this drummer is like queuing for a new passport at the embassy or some shit. And then we go on tour and then there's another bust up and the drummer walks off and we're all like, fuck it. I'm like, I can play drums. I play drums in the rehearsal. I mean, I play drums on the recording obviously, but it's like a different thing. But you know, I've kind of had a pretty recent experience of drumming it. Let's carry on. So halfway through this US tour, I'm like drumming and singing. So we've moved the drum kit to the front of the stage and I'm singing and drumming. And you know, it was fun. It was like fun to have like made it happen. And then I came back and like pretty much had a nervous breakdown when I came home. Cause I was like, oh God, there's so much stress, like so much, you know, like just being chucked into all this stuff. Like, you know, a few months before I was just an art student messing around. So I think the US label was like, let's do some more touring. And I, by that point I was kind of burnt out by that thing. And I also thought that I would do some more music really quickly. genuinely did think that. So I was like, no, it's cool. I'll just go in the studio and there'll be a new album soon. So let's not do any more shows. And then I remember my manager calls up a couple of months later and it's like, we've just been asked if you want to go on the OC, which I remember at the time it was like this hallowed thing, you know, like, oh my God, this, you know, how bands go on this show and no one knows how to do it, whatever. Everyone wants to be on the show, but you have to get like asked. So I was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. So we just went out. They changed the song. It was going to be CC. So I brought my bass because I played bass in the band in that song. And then they changed it to I Ain't Saying My Goodbyes at the last minute. But it was very weird. It was funny because we had to like play half the song, and there's an audience there of like extras. This audience is full of like LA extras, you know, really over the top people who are trying to introduce themselves to me, like during the filming. They were very like, you know, over the top, like networking, right. Which is amazing. And we had to like play the start of the song, and then as the camera pans away from the gig, everyone has to be like silent so they can record the dialogue of the characters in the show. But it was like crazy because, yeah, like I said, it seemed like you had to be asked to be on this show, and it was like, wow, that's amazing. And again, I think they wanted to do a bit more touring around to promote it, but I was so adamant that I was gonna record some more songs. You know, I was keen to do some more music, and you know, looking back, it would have been fun to try and sort of you know, maybe spend a bit more time pushing that album a bit. But it's hard. It's like I'm like a, you know, like a 24-year-old like bratty art student who's just gone through a process of like utter validation. You know, I'm like my DIY indie record that I'd made has just been signed by a major label and all this kind of shit. So I'm like, no one's telling me what to do. And hindsight's, you know, like an annoying thing. So so that's the OC. Yeah, I'm trying to think of more other anecdotes from that. I met Seth. Is that the guy's name or the character's name? God, I can't remember now.
Yeah, his character's called Seth. Is it?
Yeah.
Adam something. Yeah.
Yeah, he was really nice.
I think he was in a band. I think he was a drummer in a band or something. Yeah.
Oh right, yeah, nice. Yeah, it was just bizarre. Really, it's one of those like, is this really happening? Kind of things. But I'm super proud to be on it. In fact, in the clip, there's like probably like half a second shot of this elaborate neon sign that I designed and got made out there. And they were like, yeah, yeah, we'll ship it back to you. Because I'm like, yeah, that'll look awesome on my on the wall of my living room. And, you know, it turns up like months later, this impeccably made wooden box turns up. And somebody like forklifts it down off a truck, and it just goes like shuk, 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 this noise. And I'm like, oh man. And I open it up, this beautifully packaged thing. It's just a box full of like shattered glass, like complete, like almost like powder. It had been smashed around so much. So I was like, oh, you know, I didn't say like fragile on it or the box or anything. I think some set builder had made this amazing box for this. And then, so, yeah, you know, it's just a process of like, oh, how do I, you know, a bit of you thinks like, how shall I maximize this opportunity? And it's like, oh, get an amazing sign made and all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, sometimes there are forces at work that I don't know. I've always, yeah, trying to make things good, like being a bit of a control freak. And sometimes you're just like, oh, maybe I should just play it cool and do the bare minimum and see what happens. Usually that gets you like 90% of the way there with like stuff. I shouldn't say that though. No, I take that back. You know, all the extra work I put in, because I've just been through this with this, having played a live show in the first time in like actually 7 years, I'm remembering all these things, like stuff that I would always forget until the actual day of the gig. It's like, oh, lighting, like lights. What are the lights? I've got to make notes for, I've got to like annotate a set list really quickly for this lighting person, and there's all this other stuff, you know, and I'm trying to remember. It's all coming back to me in the build up to this gig, like all these little things that, if you care, if you are a bit of a perfectionist, it drives you crazy, because there are all these things that are kind of like out of your control. And that's the weird thing about doing like five rehearsals for one gig. You know, you're just like, what if something on the day happens, if all the strings break on my guitar or something blows up or whatever, it's just all going to be sort of like pointless, you know. And like, I almost can't handle that level of stress now. And I really worked out that actually live, now I've had a bit of a break from it and done it again, like performing live, there used to be a bit of a crossover in my mind, like being a recording artist and recording live had this kind of like crossover part that was like, well, it's I'm the person who performed it on the recordings, and it's me and I wrote the song, blah blah. But now I feel like these two entities are completely separate. There's no real overlap between what making music is like, writing and recording in a studio environment, and then getting on stage and having to do it as well as you can, and you only have one go at it, and you got to play every, and you got to like get your coordination down. Are just two completely different things. So that's my latest. Like, I feel like I've sort of realized that a bit more now, and it's given me an opinion on the life stuff. I think it's helped me separate them slightly. You know, I don't have to be, it's like a different, it's almost like a different person on stage almost. It's like, you know, you're watching someone trying to reproduce what almost someone else did in a studio. That okay, was a tangent, yeah. Wasn't it, from
the question? No, it's all good. But yeah, if we do take it back a bit, like, I was reading an article you did with DIY magazine a few years ago.
Right.
Which kind of explained a few things. Like, am I right in thinking, like, you won some kind of music awards back in the day, which kind of kick-started things for you a little bit?
Well, I was at school, when I was at art college, I was a dedicated reader of Sleaze Nation magazine. I don't know if you remember Sleaze Nation.
I don't think so.
It was kind of like, in my opinion, it was like this kind of lesser known Dazed and Confused, you know, it was sort of this underdog fashion lifestyle magazine. And there was an ad in it for Diesel U Music, which was Diesel, the jeans company that like everyone was wearing Diesel jeans that era. They were the trouser to wear the lower half body clothes du jour. And they had this, yeah, like a Enter the Art Music Awards. There's all these genres, and there was an electronica genre. And I kind of feel like, I decided that I'd just started recording electronica, because I'd been recording kind of like grungy tracks for years, and I just started trying to use a couple of old Casio keyboards through some guitar pedals to make kind of really crunchy lo-fi sort of electronica. So I was like, oh, I'll enter this with the stuff I was doing. Which I was doing under the name Souvenir, which is the name of a Cable song. Do you know the band Cable?
I don't think so.
Right, so like Cable, they're like a late 90s band from Derby, I believe. My absolute favourite guitar band. Very kind of wiry, some interesting time signatures. I just love Cable. So I enter this competition and, to my surprise, get called up a few weeks later saying, oh, you've won the electronica section. And the judge is Mark Jones, I think he's head of Wall of Sound. Wall of Sound kind of like, you know, were responsible for a lot of kind of the big beat stuff. I think like Propeller Heads and some other big beat, kind of like more dancey acts. So that was fun. I don't think I ever got my prize, which was meant to be a release on Wall of Sound. But around the time, I'd had a connection with a guy called Tim Lovely, who ran Tummy Touch Records, and had been in touch with him a couple of years before and sent some demos. And Tim got back in touch being like, you know, this is cool. You know, let me know if anything, I'm interested to basically work with you. And the stuff, he was so enthusiastic, and I was just like, you know, like sort of goofing around at that point. It had mainly resulted in me doing some design work for Diesel, because I'd sent them this, I'd made this elaborate, because I was a graphic design student, I'd made this elaborate, like, thank you image, I think, and to just send to Sam, I think, who worked there, who'd called me, and she was like, oh, this is great, you know, what like, are you a designer? I'm like, well, I'm a design student. And she was like, oh, we need like some design in the marketing department, because they had all dreamed it up, that the Diesel U Music thing was all like the marketing department dreaming it up, because I think they had loads of money to just do anything they wanted, you know. It's like music competition or an art show or whatever, and they got all this money to chuck around. So I'm there in the Diesel offices, like helping them design like fake websites about Diesel. Had this one campaign that I think got sort of semi-banned, maybe deliberately, but it was meant to be about like like staying young or something, and it was about if you drink your own piss you can live for longer or something. And we did a fake website about all this, and the website got shut down, and they were like loved it. So it's like really fun. It was for, you know, like got loads of design work out of it. But on the music side of things, the release thing was kind of like fizzling out a little bit, and then Tim at Tummy Touch was really keen. He asked to hear some other stuff, and I'd sent him like other tracks that I'd done, which were a mixture of things. And then I think so Tummy Touch ended up putting out like 7-inch, I think, is part of a series. And a little bit later, we're just talking about music, and I'd just recorded this really rock song. Like, having not done recorded a rock song for a while, and I was saying to Tim, well, you probably wouldn't like it because I know you're more kind of dance oriented and it's not electronica. And he was like, no, let's hear it. And Tim Lee said, this is awesome. You should do an album where it's just a mixture of this. It's like a mixture of rock and a mixture of electro. And I know this guy called Tom Rixton, who is a producer, and you should do a day with him and, you know, see what happens. So I go to meet Tom Rixton, who was a friend and who'd worked with Flood, you know, super producer Flood, had this room somewhere in, I think it was like Northwest London, where he actually housed a couple of his huge synths, that also kind of was like a makeshift recording studio. And we did a date. I brought some recordings that I'd had, because I would record a lot of stuff on dictaphone, even though I had like a reel-to-reel, like a fairly good setup for recording. I'd really liked recording ideas on this dictaphone and like reusing that stuff. So I had some loops and stuff, and we messed around in the day, and that day A Little Word in Your Ear came out from that session, like from just one day. It was pretty much finished, as is on the album, pretty much, that song. And so we went away from that thinking like, oh, that worked really well, and this song, you know, got written. And then we worked together, and I'd had some other songs of varying levels of being finished, and the album pretty much came together over this, you know, over like 5 months or so of just random, like being able to, because I had a job, I was working as a designer by that point. I graduated and had a job in a web design company off Brick Lane, so I was like, yeah, we did it in a couple of other sessions, and then the album was finished. I was super happy with it, did the artwork for it, and Tummy Touch are going to put it out. And then decided to play a couple of gigs, and then all of a sudden there's like someone comes up to me and says, oh, hi, I'm at so-and-so records. And I'm sorry, but I'm signed. I was saying to started saying to a couple of people, and then they're like, it's cool. They're like, no, we can, you know, we can probably still work together. And it's like, oh, okay. And I think it's through kind of a moshy connection that I ended up, so a guy called Ferdy chatted to me, and when I found out that he was the guy that had signed Portishead, I was like, oh, that's amazing. That's how the first album ended up getting licensed to Ireland, and that's why it has the Go Beat logo on it, because I was like, the Portishead albums were on Go Beat, which I think had been sort of like ingested into Ireland at some point. But I said, can I have the Go Beat logo on my, you know, it was a supposed like deal breaker when we were negotiating, but I was like, can I put Go Beat on my album? They're like, yeah, sure, whatever. So it was kind of licensed off. It was like a Tummy Touch in Ireland co-release, I suppose. But I mean, basically just been picked up by Ireland, and then it was like, quit my job and did a load of gigs.
But I was reading, you said, you know, reflecting on it, it's quite a big achievement to release the album on a major and have to make no compromises. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I can't. I'm trying to think what I would have said.
How does that sound about right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it was really helpful that the album was done, because I could, it was just like a take it or leave it thing. I do remember there was one label, which maybe I won't mention who it was, but they, who actually said, we should remix this album, do a bit more work on it. And at the time, that was the thing, like I said before, at the time I was like, no, it's perfect, it's exactly how I want it, you know. And then years later, I'm listening to the mixes thinking, actually, maybe it could have done with a a really shiny mix. But then again, I kind of think like it would have opened up a can of worms, and then you're at the mercy of a label being like, you know, we know how to make music, it's not right yet, kind of thing. And I think it was ultimately great that it was done. And, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, Ireland, they're like, at the time, I know they were saying different things to you know, other artists that we're trying to woo, but they were talking about to me about PJ Harvey, you know, they're like, we think of you as a PJ Harvey style artist, an uncompromising artist on Ireland. And I'm like, great, sounds awesome. At the time, they had their own office that was in Chris Blackwell's old house or something. There's loads of like Bob Marley stories, I think, and it felt like a kind of like a big indie. And then years later, I mean, and then it's like by the time I've got Leisure Seizure together, it's just like so different. It's like 6 years later, they're now in this like skyscraper in Kensington, and nobody that I know is there anymore, and all this kind of stuff. And then it's like, oh, okay, this is a major label, like for real. So, but it was fun back then. It was just also, it was the era of like, old school, the old music industry, you know. It was like, the album was done. I was burning CDRs for my friends and stuff. There was no like risk of it, you know, leaking or I don't know. Everything was building up to the CD coming out. There's loads of physical, loads of like stickers and flyers, and every single had, you know, most singles had like 7-inch, 12-inch version, but they also had promo versions. So there's like a promo 12-inch and a promo CD that I'm having a great time like doing all the design for, because there's like a million different designs that's needed for all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was just it was sort of a nice like do the thing and then sit back and watch it from a safe distance kind of thing.
Yeah, Shane, like, maybe going back a little bit, I was reading you talking about The Ratchet, because I was listening to the song One Horse Race, and I was thinking, oh, it's definitely got Rapture vibes. And then I read your quote saying, I think you saw them in Glasgow at some point, and you, nice. It was kind of a bit of an inspiring moment where you thought,
yeah,
the quote was, you can realise a traditional band could make a new sound.
Right. Yeah, it was the sort of like the disco beat, tipping point, I think, or like, yeah, like I don't know, the explosion, because it was interesting as a drummer, you know. I'm playing like, learned how to drum playing Smashing Pumpkins and, or trying to play Smashing Pumpkins beats and Rage Against the Machine stuff, you know. And then The Rapture comes out and it's all like this fall to the floor like thing that's like, was like really fun, and people would like dance to that. We would go to Trash, Errol's night at Trash, where I heard Rapture as well, heard LCD Sound System. And we were all in bands at the time. So it's literally like, I mean, this sounds very, you know, twee, but it's like literally the next day, band rehearsal, we're playing, we're doing this now, you know, like this is the beat. I've got a different beat I want to play in this song. And we were like, you know, the influence loop was so quick that to almost, yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, to almost be lumped in with those guys having been influenced so heavily, that it's like, yeah. And there was a bit of education going on, like I'd never heard of Gang of Four at that point. Everyone's like, oh, they're just like Gang of Four. So I'm like checking out Gang of Four. Interestingly, more recently, I think with the passing of the guitarist, the Public Image Limited stuff that I didn't even know a great deal about, like now I'm hearing like so much rapture in that stuff, which in a way is nice. You know, it's like everyone's sort of bringing a bit of what they've liked and taking it somewhere else or whatever. I wish that I knew a bit more about that at the time, because I remember being a bit upset when people would point out, you know, similarities and things. It felt, I don't know, it's just such a quick transition going from like the underdog who's just, you are just ripping off your favorite music, and then all of a sudden you're an artist yourself, and people are like, well, you're an artist, but your music just sounds like, you know, this, and you're like, oh. But it's always happened.
yeah. And I was reading about your parents' garage that you turned into a bit of a studio. Like, how useful was that, obviously, when you're just trying to get things together?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason why I've been able to become a recording artist, is just having the having a room where I could mess around in, you know, for hours. You know, and in quite a sort of old school way, because we had a reel-to-reel, multi-track reel-to-reel. So it's laying something down, because sometimes I wouldn't even, I mean, if I was trying to be disciplined, I would like listen to, I would put a drum machine from a keyboard on in my headphones or something, and I would drum along to that, so I knew at least it was staying roughly in time. But there's tracks on We Have Sound that aren't to any kind of click, but it's just lay down drums, maybe without even an idea of what was going to go over it. It was just like a drum beat that I liked, or I might have written something on the guitar and then thought, okay, right, I'll drum along, and maybe this bit will go like this, and then there'll be a fill, and then I'll do this, whatever, and then rewinding it, you know, and this reel to reel literally goes like, and then back to the beginning, and then laying down this part, and then back again, and if you made a mistake, it would be like, stop, back again, this sort of like very, you know, I feel like I'd say now that it's like, that was good practice in the kind of patience of having to get something right, and the excitement that's associated with actually capturing something, like if something really interesting happened, like almost accidentally, a lot of, you know, messing around, and it was like, oh, that's cool. It's like, and then it's like, oh, I've got it, you know, I've recorded it. Learning a bit about mixing and stuff, you know, and again, we had like a you know, you needed like a big mixing desk to handle all the channels, and you've got, you know, working out how to mix them. And yeah, you know, a lot of, something like, On the Road from We Have Sound is something that completely came from that garage, and the other things had various levels of bits and bobs that I'd done from there. And there's loads of, I mean, there's like four albums of, you know, angsty grunge stuff that I'd recorded before then, that, you know, like one day I opened a bit up on, for the 10-year anniversary of We Have Sound, we did a vinyl box set, and there's one of the discs on that is called Pre Have Sound, and that does have some older things that I pulled out from this kind of period that led up to We Have Sound coming together. And it is kind of all over the place. It's kind of like a mixture of this, of trying to make rocky stuff sound a bit, have a bit more synths or electronic stuff in there, you know, and a lot of it's instrumental, and but there's way more like actual straight up kind of like rock tracks as well that I recorded. But yeah, loads of that. It was a great feeling. I remember just recording something and then listening to it back, and I get to the end and I'd be like, oh, I just listened to it one more time. You know, once you kind of bounce down, once you've done a master mix as well, because the mixing was a performance in itself, because the reel-to-reels are so noisy that I would do a bit of a live mix performance, like solo some tracks, and if there was a real clunky mistake in something, I'd like mute, you know, live. And so getting it down, the final version down, was a thing in itself. And I would then listen, I would stay up just listening to this thing that I'd made just over and over again, get to the end and be like, oh, I just want to listen to the beginning again, and then just like that would go all the way through, and then beginning again, and you know, I still get that fundamental reward from listening to something that I've made, being like, this is really great. Sorry, you're getting very long answers.
No, spot on, mate. You know, when I said you were coming on, I asked people for questions and the Croups got in touch because they said they actually recorded a video for Hey Scenesters. I don't know if it's in your garage or in the in one of your basements somewhere or something.
That was a flat that I shared with a few people, one of whom was a guy that I was at college with called Chris Cairns, who's a video director, and we lived in this weird flat in Wapping that was I think it was meant to be an office, but for some reason they'd converted it into residential place, but it was a ground floor and basement flat, and all the bedrooms were in the basement, so it's like no windows, really weird, but it's like great for a student because you're up late and you sleep in till like, you know, 1 in the afternoon. But next door, Chris had found a door in his bedroom that led into a flat next door that was like derelict, so it was really spooky, and these were huge flats as well. And we had but it was also like the basement of this other flat was sort of like a building site. I mean, say derelict, it was like an unfinished flat. It was full of like rubble and dust, and we had spent a few days moving all this crap over to one side and sealing it off, like trying to seal it off with big like sheets of cling film, and then hoovering it and try and turned it into like a studio for filming things. And we did one of my early videos down there, which is lost to time now. But he started to make a name for himself as a video director. And there's a Klaxons video that was done down there as well. And some other things. I think he ended up doing I got to remember this because I think he did LCD's that video for Daft Punk Is Playing at My House by LCD Sound System, I think. He was doing like videos for loads of cool people. So, but sometimes, yeah, I think people would get changed in my bedroom, and then my bedroom was like the changing room.
Fair play, yeah. And yeah, like just in terms of recording, like you mentioned you playing the drums. Might be an obvious question, but were you playing everything when it came to recording the first album?
Yeah. Yeah, I did play everything, and it became a bit of a, it has become a bit of a sort of like, that's what makes it a Tom Veck song, I feel like. I was enjoying playing in bands and stuff, and I did recordings with the bands that I was in. But this stuff was like, yeah, I'm kind of like in control of everything. Apart from in CC, there's this like kind of Aphex Twin drum sort of like program drum breakdown thing that Tom Rixton did. That's cool. That I have to credit him for. But yeah, no, the deal is, I mean, cause I enjoy it. It's just like, you know, I have musician friends that like love the idea of writing a demo and then getting, you know, the best session players to like play it on recording, and I see how nice that is, but it's weird. But I would just like stop at the demo. I'd be like, well, I would like to play. I would like to have, you know, to be able to say I did that bass line or I played those drums. I just enjoy it, you know. And the beauty of recording with computers is that you can cut out all the bad stuff and just keep the good bit and be like, I did that, you know. So when it comes to like playing with a live drummer, I have to be like, yeah, sorry, it's just this one break that's like looped up for 4 minutes. I never played it 4 minutes myself, but you're gonna have to now.
yeah I was thinking that with Ain't Saying My Goodbyes, is a guitar at the beginning on a loop.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, there's probably more of that early stuff that's live-ish, but there's definitely looped parts of that song. Yeah.
That sounds cool, yeah. And then just in terms of, you know, mentioned other bands, like, did you feel part of a scene at that time? Or were you kind of just doing your own thing, really?
Yeah, there definitely was, at the beginning, there was a night called White Heat that a lot of bands played in, and I was in a few bands that played there with some friends of mine of like alternate bands. And there was this band called, there's this short-lived band called Intense Dudes, which maybe played a couple of shows, and I like guested on drums on a song of a couple of shows that they did. And then that turned into a band. There was a band called Bulls, where they like dressed up in like tennis clothes and had loads of ping pong balls and stuff. But there was a gig that one of them, my buddy Ferry, who's in a band called Semi-Finalists, I was in other bands with him, he couldn't make. So Bulls played a one-off gig and changed their name to Testicicles. And then I think that led to them. And then there was, you know, someone in the audience and Testicicles got signed. And so it was kind of fun. It was around the time of Testicicles and my stuff. I'm trying to think. And some other bands that you would start to see at various venues. And then, you know, ended up being like festival lineups that you would see people of. I remember there was one festival where like I was seeing quite a lot of Editors seemed a band. You just get to know these bands because you're like, you know, playing on similar things and that. So, but I think the White Heat scene was great. Like all that stuff immediately before it getting real was great fun. It was just like playing gigs to a handful of people just for the sake of it, almost just for the practice of like of playing. It's just like a thing to do. And like I said, like trash, you know, going to like sort of listening to that, all the music that was influential at that time. So mini scene, yeah. But I think that it quickly, I don't know, I think White Heat moved, or it's kind of hard to describe it, but I think because when bands became like a bit bigger to play White Heat, it's almost like, you know, you sort of like graduate into being, and you sort of leave this scene behind. And at the time it seems like, oh great, you know, my star is in ascension. And and then you look back on it and it's almost a bit of a shame that people went off in their own ways. It all got a bit serious, and then, you know, we're all talking about record deals and record labels and all that kind of stuff then, and then trying to make more music. And I think I kind of like locked myself away a little bit because I spent so many years recording on my own. I was like, oh, this will be easy. I will just go back and record on my own again. And looking back on it, you know, it was working with Tom Rixton 100% that got We Have Sound made. And I had to kind of learn how to do that for myself in order to make Leisure Seizure, basically. Like by that point, I had Pro Tools skills and could do all the chopping and stuff, and ended up mixing that album, and then onward, going on from that, it's been, yeah, you know, like I've done the whole thing. It's only the very new Symbols, the last album proper, that I delegated the mix to my friend Jolien, because I was just, you know, it kind of swings around. In the past, I've really enjoyed doing mixing, and this time around, I just really couldn't bear. Because sometimes mixing is like, you're just like, just make it sound better. Just make it sound awesome. Like, you just want to click your fingers and do it. And then sometimes you're like, oh, I'm going to get stuck in and work out how to do it. So, you know, but now I'm kind of like back on being interested with mixing, having dug out I did an outtakes mini album for Leisure Seizure's 10-year anniversary and dug out some tracks from that I mixed up, that I enjoyed the mixing process of that and kind of got them more presentable. And it was funny because I had to get back in touch with Ireland, who had no idea that these songs even exist, and say, you know, I guess I'm giving you these songs because it's still under this contract. You know, it's like the contract is like anything that's recorded during this time that you were signed. And in order for me to say, it was important for me to say, yes, these are outtakes from Leisure Seizure. I could have been like, these are, you know, six new songs I've just come up with, and I would own them outright. So, I mean, that's just weird label, you know, bureaucracy, but I did all this work and gifted this major label some more songs.
Yeah, how does it work with that? Is it like, obviously it's like a 6-year gap, but is the contract just in terms of albums rather than time span?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I mean, everything, the contract will say that they'll own all music recorded during that period, and then they own it, you know, for a certain amount of time after that. It's a bit of a shit. I mean, it's different for different people, but you know, it's good when a label doesn't keep the rights forever, so you might be able to kind of get some of your music back. So there's varying things going on there that I'm in the middle of sorting out at the moment.
Oh, right, okay.
But yeah, I mean, at the moment it's still owned by Ireland, and in a lot of cases, everyone who would have done a major deal at that level won't, you know, will have signed away their music probably indefinitely. Which is how it works. But I mean, you hear stories of even shelved albums. You know, they can refuse to release it and also refuse to get it back to you. So, you know, I mean, there's sad stories there. It's a real shame when you hear that kind of stuff. And obviously, you know, the recent Fortet and Domino stuff recently, you know, you're just like, oh, it's a bit of a pain. But I don't know. We're entering like a whole new world. I feel like artists are way more wise to what the contracts actually say in them. Because even though, I mean, we did put a lot of time into my contracts originally, but at the same time, you are just like, yeah, let's go. Yeah, it's all going to be great. You know, you're sort of like looking at the contract through the eye of it just being, you know, onwards and upwards kind of thing. So, which is a nice way to look at it, really. At the time, nobody wants to be like, yeah, well, what if, you know, what if this album becomes like a modest, you know, underground album? And you're like, okay. It would have been good to, you know, actually having a plan for that would be like, oh, that would be a good idea. You know, the idea is sort of nice, the idea of when a band stays on a label, like all throughout their career, there is something like gorgeous about that. I think you sort of get lucky there, or have an incredible foresight of knowing exactly where you stand. But you know, when some A&R person is telling you that you're like the next Beck, you're sort of like, oh, cool, that sounds good to me. but I'm kind of happy that it didn't, you know, go bonkers in a way. I am now, at least. Making the second album is a frustrating process, but I'm very proud. I'm really proud of that. Mainly because it just felt like there wasn't even going to be an album. You know, the hardest thing was like none of my, you know, all my mates that are just like, you know, working their first jobs at companies and all that kind of stuff. And I'm there being like, oh, I can't, you know, I built a recording studio and I can't write any songs. And they're like, boo hoo. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. No one's no one has any sympathy for me. So
what in terms of, yeah, the obvious question is why the 6 years, which I'm sure you're sick of getting asked. But he's saying it was a
problem. Well, I haven't been asked in a while, actually.
Oh, fair enough.
I mean, it was just, you know, it was like I was trying. You would go into a room where songs have previously, well, actually, not that songs have previously been written. I mean, that's the thing. You're like, I'm in a new house. I've got my new recording, a new recording space, and I'm kind of like, it seems very, I'm very like aware of the fact that this is what I'm meant to be doing, you know. And before then, music had always been made as like an enjoyable pastime. And you kind of thought like, oh, if only I had more time to do this, I would do way more. And then, you know, the irony was, it was not lost on me that it worked the other way, and I just didn't seem to do anything. I think I'd got a, you know, raised opinion of myself, but also because you sort of. I mean, it might have been because I'd forgotten what it was like. Like when you're knocking around ideas, it all sounds bad, you know. It's all just like little things, and especially, you know, like drums. Everything sounds, or drums take so long to like mix up to sound remotely decent that you're putting down a drum track and it kind of sounds ordinary, and that is the way I had written by, was just recording and seeing what's happened. But I'm finding that I was just recording loads and loads and loads of stuff that I was just like, this, what is this? This is just a recording of average things. You know, it's not up to standard. It's like, whatever. So, I remember a point when I had done something and was like, oh, maybe I'll just bounce. I'll like, because now I've got an iPod. It's like, you know, it's like years had passed and we're all using iPods now, and it's like, I pop it on my iPod and get home, have some dinner, and then I'm like, I want to listen to that thing I was working on today. Like, I want to listen to that, and I hadn't had that in a while. And that was like, I remember that being an early version of a chore, and I was like, I think I'm in the zone now, because I'm being, think something's happening where like songs are just coming together and they're interesting me enough, and I'm getting that thing where I want to listen to them. And that just happened to be like, there was a point in my, it's like, in my defense, it was like 5 years later, but by the time the album actually comes out, because, you know, it's amazingly was released by Island, you know, honoring their agreement, there's all this build up. So there's like 4 months of build up, which is always frustrating for artists. When you've got an album ready and you want everyone to hear the whole thing, and they're like, yeah, well, we'll do a single, and then like a month later we'll do another single, and you know, I was probably pretty bratty around that time as well. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about it as well, because the thing that threw me a little bit as well was like, about a year after, well, when We Have Sound came out, someone in my band's brother set up a MySpace on behalf of me, just, and it's like early days of MySpace, and I end up sort of like taking over the management of it, because he's like replying to fans pretending to be me, that I was like, oh, dude, you probably shouldn't do that. And then it's the whole like social media explosion, and I'm a bit like, I just don't, this is all feels a bit odd for me, because I really liked the thing that attracted me to being a musician when I was young, was this idea of like hiding behind this, you know, like the music and the artwork being what you know about this entity, and the real person is like this mysterious, you know, untouchable kind of entity. And then now it's all like, oh, hey, it's really me, and these are my thoughts on everything, and this is a picture of some food I'm eating, and it's just like, oh God, this is so different to, you know, I thought, you know, it was cool to make music and be a musician and that be your thing. And so I think I really struggled with getting on board with that. And still, I don't think I'm a, you know, like, I'm sure a lot of people will say this, but it's like, you know, social media is not the most rewarding thing, but it's like a necessary evil. But it's great. It is great. It's a great way to, obviously, to I mean, it's essential way to reach out to people, and it's nice to hear nice things via that medium. And I'm on board with it now, but it like I say, it was kind of nice to have actually got an album out there that was really the old fashioned way, like do the CD and do the artwork, and that's what everyone's going to see. People are going to make their impressions of you based on this thing that you can like really spend a lot of time over and get right.
Yeah, it's interesting. Go on, sorry. Yeah.
I was saying, without getting, you know, opening up that whole like where are we now with digital culture?
yeah. It's interesting though, you mentioned like, you know, like struggling with the writing side. Was that because, you know, we've talked to people who say, you know, they need people to bounce ideas off. Do you think you'd have benefited from that, or did you have people that you could kind of work with in that respect?
I guess I didn't. I had actually called up Tom Rixton after a few years. I was like, oh, I've got to get Tom Rixton, who produced We Have Sound, back, because that's where the magic was. You know, by that point I was really despairing. And Tom had actually moved to Argentina and was like running a hotel in Argentina. So we hatched this plan that was like, oh, actually it's cheaper for me to go over to Argentina and rent this amazing studio in Buenos Aires than doing something in like Shoreditch. but then it was just, again, that was just like too much. It's like, I'm in this amazing studio with we'd hired all these synths and stuff. And just there being like, it's not just that makes music happen, you know. It's like, and however, I mean, there were some songs I ended up did manage to salvage some bits from that session did end up in a couple of songs on Legisesia, which was great, but it was a very elaborate, I mean, you know, not wasteful, but well, it was wasteful probably. and then Tom, we did a bit of a session. We did do a bit more, in my studio on the second album. And also I got in, worked with a guy called Liam Howe, who was in Sneaker Pimps, who I discovered that he lived around the corner from my London studio. And I'd loved, been a huge fan of Sneaker Pimps, and other, you know, quote unquote trip hop stuff, which I still maintain like has some of the most amazing production to it. So, I kind of wanted, I was kind of hoping that my album would sound like Sneaker Pimps getting Liam in, but it did. I don't think it sounds like Sneaker Pimps. but that was, it was helpful. Yeah. The idea of actually working with people in some way was then helpful for me to go away. And then I found it a lot easier to then go away and know what I needed to do, or to spend more time on trying to fix something. So yeah, exactly. I think it's only really luck, the third album, that was that where I was most isolated, I think, or like most on my own. Everything on that album I did apart from mastering it, I might have even mastered it myself now. Thinking about it now, I might have even just slammed it through a mastering plugin. But yeah. But mostly it's kind of nice. It is nice to have a little bit of external input. But I think I suffer from just being a snob about, like, you know, the most that you can do on your own, the most that you can be the artist, like, you know, say that you're the artist of this stuff. And to be honest, I think I didn't even realize. It was almost like I didn't really realize how many collaborators David Bowie had, you know, how many people are involved in all these things. I think for some reason I assumed that all these bands and artists were doing a lot more on their own, to be honest. And then once I'd managed to do a bit of that, I think that was like, oh well, I'll keep trying to do that. But yeah, no, it's cool. I've done some collaborations over the years. There's like pros and cons to both approaches, and like yeah. But I think for the time being, like a Tom Vec thing means that I have done, at least in the writing and performance side of things, like the whole thing.
Hmm. Yeah, did I read you did a project with Johnny Marr at some point?
Yeah, that was, he wasn't directly involved. That was a Ray-Ban project that he was kind of curating. And they got a few bands to use some elements that he had provided. So I made a song out of some elements that Johnny Marr provided. So I never met him or anything.
Okay.
But I did really enjoy that project. It's just bizarre. Like just bizarre things happen. You know, you do an album and then one day your manager's like, oh, yeah, you know, Ray-Ban want you to write a song and then go play it in Hong Kong. And you're like, okay. Yeah, that sounds loads of fun. And they're like, what's your, you know, send over your, do you want any free sunglasses? And it's like, yeah. So I'm like drowning in shades and playing a few shows and, you know, it's just, I mean, like super fun stuff. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, is that a similar thing with Grand Theft Auto? Did they just ask you for a song kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was an existing song. Yeah, it was a B-side, One Horse Race. And in fact, that is a song that had come from my garage studio, my home garage studio in its totality. And it's surprising. Yeah, I think like I have quite a big segment of my fan base, I think, discovered me from that song on that game soundtrack, I think.
Mm. It's funny because I interviewed Luke Jenner from The Rapture, and exactly the same thing happened with them. But I've got this right. I think, well, they did a GTA song, and I think it was that one that became massive in Australia for some reason.
right.
So yeah, it's funny how these things happen. To get to different audiences, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask quickly about the label. During that 6 years, were they kind of pushing for you to get an album out, or were they quite relaxed?
No, I mean, they were pretty relaxed. Like I said, there's people moved around. Like, the person that signed me was all of a sudden at a different label, and all of the contacts were gone, really. So there wasn't really any, there wasn't any pressure. Every now and again, I'd be at a gig or something, and someone would be like, oh, do another record. And I know it's like intended as a nice thing, but I'm there being like, oh God.
It's the last thing I need.
Yeah, like, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know really. I mean, I don't see how it could have been any different. I would love the idea of having a collaborator that maybe we could have really pushed some stuff through, but I think it was just like the end of one era and the start of another. I don't know what the album in between, if there would have been an album in between those, I don't really know what it would have been. I was most interested to push to keep doing stuff, to focus on the stuff from We Have Sound that was most unique, you know, because there were some influences showing, and then there were songs like CC and stuff like that, which I don't think, like, no one's ever told me that sounded like anything, and that became like CC and The Lower the Sun were songs I was like, that's my sort of, I want it to be a bit more like that, you know. I don't think I did another disco beat track since, actually, I suppose. So it was a bit of a case of kind of shedding that, like not carrying on with the same formula, but somehow, you know. And then it did seem to be a bit of an interviewer thing where people would say they don't, you know, this stuff I don't know how to describe it. It just sounds like a Tom Vex song, and I'd be like, that's the nicest thing you could say.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember thinking that when I think Affairs Head Aroused might have been on Zane Lowe.
Right.
And like instantly thinking this is great kind of thing. And obviously you came back to good reception. Was that kind of, what kind of, I don't know, emotions did that stir up for you? Is it a bit of relief or kind of good to be back kind of thing?
Oh yeah, I mean, it was great. It was great.
Yeah, yeah.
I felt like I'd sort of grown up as, I mean, I obviously was quite a bit more grown up. I was quite keen. There was a point where it looked like that the release day could be before I turned 30, but I did end up being 30, turning 30 before that album came out, you know, and everyone's, it's so funny, like, when you're that age, you know, people are like, oh my God, I'm turning 30. And then, you know, years later, you're like, that's such a dumb thing to be worried about. Like, oh my God, it's like a good thing. You know, I mean, I feel like, you know, you spend your entire 20s just learning that you're no longer a teenager. And then I think by the time you're 30, you're like, I think I had my shit together then. And that was nice to then be like, you know, I want to make touring, like touring's not about it just being like messy rock and roll bullshit now. It's like let's try and be sophisticated about things. Let's make the live show interesting and putting a lot of effort. I enjoyed putting effort into things, you know, because that album I've had a bit of a kind of a shiny presentations thing to it. I think that the artwork and everything was very like text-based and clean and bright, and that was kind of what I was after, you know. And I would change my hair because I used to like I had a parting in my hair, was all smart and all that kind of stuff. It was a big like identity change, like a sort of a new identity around that. So it was nice, and play a bunch of, you know, play a load of interesting shows and meet a lot of cool people and kind of get it out. But then towards the end of that album, it was like, it was clear that like, this is the end of this like grandiose era. This was my like major label album, and I was very keen to, you know, then start working with an indie and stuff, be a bit more sort of, you know, a bit more down a notch after that. And that's where and then I was on Moshi Moshi, and for the third album, and that was really nice.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If noughties guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series: the Noughties Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail; my favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era; Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill; Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Noughties Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Yeah, one from Richard on Twitter. We kind of covered it, really, but he did say, you know, the gap in between albums. Did you ever sometimes see the success of your contemporaries and think you should have kept going?
That's the problem. I was like doing it as fast as I could. I suppose I was trying to keep going, but I mean, I'm pretty kind of sort of zen about it now. I don't think being famous is really great at the moment. Not necessarily being famous, but I mean, it would be nice to have reached more people with the music, I think. but I don't begrudge. I mean, it's awesome seeing some things that I was rubbing shoulders with, you know, like going on to great things. I remember thinking that there was that Klaxon's track, like Golden Scans, I thought was an incredible track that deserved to be massive. And there was also a Friendly Fires track, Jump in the Pool by Friendly Fires. Do you know that song?
Yeah, yeah, good song.
I remember hearing that thinking, shit, that's the song that I wanted to have written. I think Paul Etworth had a hand in that one. I've always had a lot of time for Paul, and obviously he had a lot to do with a lot of great albums around that time. It's got a really amazing like middle eight in it. So, you know, I think it was a shame. Like, I think when I was at that exact time, it was I remember feeling a bit intimidated by stuff that might have sounded a bit like what I was doing, you know, and was big. And it's a shame that there wasn't, there didn't seem, or to me, that there wasn't much of a scene associated with that. I think I just had the wrong attitude. I think it's a bit of growing up involved there. But I didn't really begrudge it at the time. It was nice to, it was cool to see that stuff happening. So I think I've always had a bit of like a bit more of an independent spirit. Like if something's going to be big, it does kind of have to be on my terms, you know? So, I still kind of believe like it could happen. I mean, that's the kind of fun thing about music, I think, is that it's nice that older tracks can still be discovered, you know, potentially by a lot of people. Just need that one, you know, just need that one Netflix sync and then it's all good. I'm kind of obsessed with the idea now that I think there's a song of mine called Broke that I feel like would be great for a Netflix title sequence. But I'm trying to like, I don't know. I don't even know. I know it's published. It's like, who's my publisher? Like, I'm trying to, I feel like I want my publisher to like go out and try and nail that, you know? It's very weird, like how things actually happen like that. Who knows, you know, but I've sort of like lived by the sword and died by the sword in that sense. So, I'm really proud of everything, to be honest. I mean, I seem to, in the last couple of years, I've had a few messages from people about how much songs have meant to them and stuff. And that is really, it's really great to hear that.
Yeah, when I was listening to your stuff this week, got really vivid memories of that first album, like of walking to a girl's house I was seeing in college, listening to the songs. And I don't know why, it's just really like really properly nostalgic kind of thing. And
yeah, I mean, it is good memories. Power of music, isn't it? I mean, it's like I think I feel like you kind of understand a bit more why. I don't know whether it's why labels are keen to kind of go after that like teenage demographic, because it almost seems a bit creepy when there's a bunch of, you know, much older people like trying to target that. But then you realize that, like you say, like music that happens to have soundtracked a time in your life that's so like potent, these memories are getting saved with all this kind of rich contextual stuff, right? That you think that's why the people are so dedicated to songs from that era, which is in a way it is inspiring to think like it is still worth putting music out to see if just one person has, you know, gets a connection forged with what you do and your music might be associated with, you know, some positive feeling or something, and it can be used to like dredge that back, right? I think that's the same, like I have it with the, like the opening, few seconds of Jeff Buckley's Grace album would takes me exactly back to like being in a bedroom as a teenager. It's amazing. It's kind of amazing. So trying to forge some more grown up memories as well.
It's interesting though. I had Ryan from Yard Act on, and I think like this thing where age is becoming less important, I think. I don't know, maybe in terms of bands becoming popular or, I don't know, kicking on kind of thing.
Yeah, that's cool.
Because they're all like 30s plus kind of things. So I don't know if...
Who's that, sorry?
I don't know. Yard Act?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't hear that. Yeah, yeah, they're great, yeah. Yeah, it's good. And I kind of think like it's almost better to be I don't know. It's almost like, I don't know, you do just get a bit wiser as you get a bit older. And if you're in a position of like an element of responsibility, because everything is so like archived now, I guess you got to make sure you don't make a misstep. Yeah, no, it's all good. I mean, I think that's the thing about being a solo artist a little bit, is that you can't really, like, you know, a band can disband, but I mean, I feel like I could like take a really long break, and then maybe there'd be some kind of you know, Rick Rubin, old man, old Tom Veck, you know, gets like wheeled out, some kind of deep album. I don't know. Like, I like the idea. I like the idea of keeping going.
Have you produced other bands and artists yourself? Or not really?
Not a great deal, really. I mean, there was a lot of talk about it, but it kind of enters this world of kind of co-writing and producing stuff on the chance that it might, you know, be successful. And I kind of feel like I have that risk enough with my own stuff, and it's a bigger payoff if it's if it like ends up being me. I kind of think, because I kind of have another career as a designer, I much prefer doing design for income, you know, like as a service. It's like if somebody needs something from me, music production's always been a bit tricky, because I don't really know how it's going to happen, you know. I think there's so much that when I do my own production, there's so much that I have to disregard, that it's not, I don't think I can go straight in and like, you know, produce, or at least maybe I don't even want that pressure. I'm not sure. I've done a little bit, and I've done some collaborative projects that have actually been pretty enjoyable. I did a couple of tracks with a friend of mine, Olga Bell, as No Thank You, which is coming up to 10 years ago now. There's like a two-track EP we put out. That all happened pretty easily. I think as I'd kind of learnt more production skills working on that second album. Yeah, not really. I mean, I don't know. They haven't. I mean, I think I'd always. I don't know. I don't know. Weirdly, I mean, I have been approached by a couple of people for like collaborative stuff that I have like on the backlog. So, and that's might be more of a mix of genres actually, which would be quite interesting.
On Instagram, got a bit of a broad one from Tom Rich, who just says, "What is your writing process?"
What is the writing process? It's like messing around and then being like, oh, I should record that. There's something interesting. So it might be playing something on the guitar, or messing around with like a keyboard part, and then hearing something in that that is interesting, and then putting it down and elaborating on it, I think. So it's kind of collage-y, I suppose. It's kind of like grabbing a bit and sticking it down, and then see if I can stick things around it. More recently, like I said, I used to start with sort of drum. I used to sometimes just record some drums and then like jam along with myself, almost like over the top. And more recently, it's like, it'll be more of a melodic part that I'll turn into a loop and loop up and then drum over that and then work out some arrangement and some other parts and things. But it's very like computer. It's very like production based. And then there's like this second process of getting as far as I can with something or as far as I have time to, and then closing it and then coming back to it. And sometimes I open something up and I don't even remember having done it, which I kind of like, because you sort of get this objective listening perspective on it. It's like, oh, that's quite cool there. And then I'll work a bit more on it and then close it again and then opening it up and close it. So it's lots of like incremental things. And the nicest thing is when I sort of open something up and it's like nearly ready. And I'm like, oh, cool. The vocals is usually a pretty tricky. Quite often I'll do like nonsense vocals just to get melodies down. And then turning that into lyrics can sometimes take the longest part. But it's annoying that I still want to have lyrics on it. So even though it takes time, it's like I just make an instrumental album, but I don't know. Like I like if when I eventually come up, manage to get some lyrics down, I'm kind of pleased that they're on there. So yeah.
And then Tom Rich again says, would you play Elsewhere music venue in Margate?
Mm. Good idea. There's talk of it, yeah. So watch this space, yeah. Yeah, shout out to Elsewhere. Big fan of Sammy, who runs it and all the gigs he put on. I saw some incredible bands earlier this year that came through. I saw Jockstrap, were incredible, Folly Group, Crack Cloud, who I'd seen before, who'd played in Margate like years before in an even smaller venue. That was incredible. Lunch Money Life, who I got to support at my London show. We're pretty spoilt with the bands that come through actually in Margate. So it's very, and Elsewhere seems like a great venue to play. So yeah, I'm hoping that I will be able to, yeah.
Cool. Julian Thomas just says up or down. This is someone you know.
Yeah. Hi, Jolien. Yeah. Jolien mixed new cymbals. So that's I guess it's a mixer joke.
Right. Okay. Fair
play. The answer always being up, obviously. Yeah. And then you got to ask your mixer to make it warm and punchy is the other thing that mixers hate hearing. Warm and punchy.
Squid Senpai says, any plans for another album?
I mean, there's plans of one, but it's in that really embryonic stage that I couldn't say, because I've just done I put out new cymbals and then I remixed it all for newer cymbals, and so I feel like I've really done that. I've really squeezed the stuff out of that album. And I mean, I'm excited about new stuff. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, plans right now. I think it always happens that I like the idea of making like a grunge rock album. I've just rediscovered a couple of really like guitar bands that are really doing it for me at the moment. Swerve Driver, and Rival Schools. I'm just like smashing those albums at the moment. So, and they're like real feel good for me, it's like feel good, yeah, guitar music. So maybe it could be a rocky album. But I usually say that, and then I don't know. But yeah, I ended up putting together a new live band to play this London show, and they're locally based, so potentially there'll be a bit of a more of a live sound to it. I don't know. Yeah. But I will try. I mean, I was thinking that, you know, I've managed to put something out in some form once a year over the last 3 years, including the outtakes. I mean, there was the remix album, and then there's the outtakes album the year before, and then New Symbols came out the year before that. So I like the idea, and this is, you know, a promise that I might not be able to fulfill, but of getting something out next year, maybe an EP. So we'll see. But feel free to hassle me about that.
Mr. Sun 25 just says, please come to Brazil or Argentina. Have you played over there before?
No, like I said, I recorded a bit of Leisure Seizure in Argentina, and I have been to Brazil, but it was quite a random reason. I sort of DJ'd. But yeah, both amazing places to go to. So hopefully, fingers crossed. I mean, it's quite touring, doing those kind of shows are a bit ambitious, but I think it seems to me like that the best thing for I mean, the way those things will happen, I think, is if a festival, if I get booked for a festival. So, you know, feel free to campaign your local festival organizer to put bands you like on the bill, because it's a lot easier than, you know, doing your own show is kind of like it's hard to achieve these days. So yeah, festival stuff is usually how that happens. So I'd love to play in those countries.
Yeah, similar question from April Stu, really, just in terms of America. Any plans to visit in the next 2 years? And if not, what should we do to make you come to the States? Is that a similar thing? Get a festival to book
you?
Yeah,
I reckon. Yeah, I mean, that is... Yeah.
I can imagine going quite well, down quite well in America. Have you had a bit of success over there?
I mean, I think it's... You know, it feels like the sort of... Yeah, second biggest area of interest. Like I loved playing some shows in LA when KCRW were behind the third album quite a bit. That was amazing, and always had fun playing New York as well. It's just the two coasts, really. It's like the stuff in the middle was... It was only on my first album that we did like an actual, you know, tour of sorts through the middle of America, which was, you know, incredibly interesting. But there was quite a lot of drama going on as well around that tour, so it's hard to take it all in. But I would love to. It's just you know, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of lots of, you know, there's lots of burnout happening with live music at the moment, and bands finding it hard financially to play, and then almost like, I think emotionally, the sort of, it is quite a stressful process. So you know, I think festival setups that can make it easy for bands to accept shows, you know, with guaranteed fees and all that kind of stuff is the future, and it's kind of best for everyone, really. Yeah, so hopefully. But I mean, the last couple of albums have been self-released and stuff, so it's been very you know, it's very much been a sort of a DIY thing, and I'm hoping to get back with establishing a bit more of a structure around that, whether it's a new label or a team of sorts. So yeah, hopefully. I'd love to.
And then, I mean, it's a similar one again, but from Flame Me Up, are there any Are there plans for more gigs in the future? The recent Lafayette one was ace.
Oh. There might be a London thing next year. So keep an eye out for that. And I hope there'll be more shows, yeah.
The KB show says okay, who or what is CC?
Yeah, I had lots of different answers for that back in the day. And sometimes with lyrics, it's like cool and not to know, isn't it? So I'd say it's whatever you would like it to be. But nothing that would get you in trouble. I'm not going to like suddenly, you know, like do a gotcha to everyone that liked that song, being like, oh, actually, it's about this. cancelable thing. It's essentially I'm singing to somebody in that song, so it's them.
Okay. And then one from Mr. Chance Fisher. I don't know if this means, he says, what's your favorite song? I don't know if he means of yours or of all time.
Oh man, usually have
impossible question.
Yeah. I quite like yes. Right now my favorite song is Autodidact by Swerve Driver.
Okay.
That's the one that I'm listening to a lot. And I was listening, like I said, I was listening to a lot of Rival Schools as well. Favorite. So if I'm indulged to answer that question, like favorite song of mine, is You'll Stay from Luck is my favorite song. Just to say,
Is that to play live as well, or is that different?
No. I think just what's going on in the song, really. The sounds of it. It kind of has a bit of almost a bit of a jungly drums thing going on, but it I don't know. It just gives me lots of feels, that one. And it has an extended ending, which I sort of developed. I developed a solo thing, like a solo performance thing, a few years ago to play another show in LA, and kind of added a bit on the end of that song that it really gives me some feels. It's really weird. It's like you can if I'm performing of it, I kind of like tear up almost. It's really weird. It's like like I found something that I can sing over some things, and it will make me like really really put a lump in my throat. It's really weird. Like as I kind of enjoy that, like doing that to myself, you know, because that is the power of, you know, that is the power of music. Still gets me. I got to say, recently, so there's a new Young Fathers album coming out, and a track of theirs called Geronimo. I think it's the first single on this new album. Kind of teared me up when I was listening to that, and I love that. I just love that music can actually like bring you to tears.
Cheers, mate. We'll just finish on two questions then. Has there been a high point so far, and is there anything you would have done differently, do you think?
Oh man, I should probably answer them in reverse order, so it I don't know, well, not that one's negative. I mean, that's the thing, anything I would have done differently, I don't know, because I kind of don't see how it would have gone any other way. But I think it would have been nice, it would have been helpful, I think it would have been a bit better for my I want to say like mental health or like nerves, if there was some real push into getting some more music out, you know, sooner after the first album, because I think it would have maybe helped my confidence a bit. But it's difficult because I sort of like the way it ended up panning out. I liked that I came back with this album that seemed so sort of the second album did just seem so potently. It has like a real anger in there that came from the things that had, you know, kind of gone into it. You know, Leisure Seizure. It's literally the album name is literally like what happened to me in that space. And I not that I would want to put myself through a grueling thing all the time. I feel like, you know, there's that old adage that it's like, you know, you have your whole life to write your first album and then you've got to do your second one in a couple of years. And I think you do I feel like I wasn't letting myself get away easily. But that's in the premise of it being a very personal album. But I could have just worked with a few people and made a fun record in the middle would have been good. So, and then high points. I mean, the gigs are high points. I remember playing Shepherd's Bush Empire for the Leisure Seizure London show, and that was pretty amazing. Getting to travel, getting to go to Hong Kong and the LA shows has been great. I got to collaborate with DJ Shadow. That was amazing because, you know, he's been a total hero of mine. That was a real high point. And then I think every time another album is done, and it's another like milestone in the discography, you know, the real big ones, the albums, you know, like having done four albums now, it's like I like getting to an album four. I don't know. A lot of my favorite bands just did three albums. It seemed like that was about as much as a band could handle, you know, without before they completely imploded or things moved on. So I kind of feel like I'm in, you know, getting to the fourth album is some kind of achievement. And I'm really pleased with the graphic side of things. Like we had the symbol that's on the front of New Symbols, the inverted eject button. Like I got that printed up big as a banner for the show. And when I saw pictures coming back, you know, of that, I'm kind of happy with the design. treatment as well. So
have you always done your own artwork kind of thing?
The album cover for Luck, I had kind of mocked it up, and my friend Ferry, who's a very cool illustrator, drew the head shape for Luck. But broadly, yeah, I mean, it's like I'm interested in graphic design. I'm not going to not design my album covers, you know. There might be a point where I actually finally manage to do some actual collaboration, but it's just one of those things. It's like it interests me to do all these bits, but then it's annoying when it's like I'm the one who'll get hassled for artwork, you know, for like some different size of a live ad or something. It's like I can't. It's like I'm the designer. I got to do that. Can you add this? You know, can you add this date to this design? It's like, oh, okay.